The title of my talk today is Finance for the People, Not for the Bankers. And a lot of the talk is going to be about how the financial system that we've had for a number of decades now has really been oriented to help the bankers, not the people. And we've seen the fruits of that kind of system in the economic crisis that we're all facing now. And in order to get out of this mess, there are a lot of things that have to be done, but one of them is that we have to get together and try to create a new financial system that will be for the people and not for the bankers as it has been. The Great Depression of the 1930s was a depression caused by liberalism. Now, let me explain that. Liberalism, in the way that I'm using it here and the way economists use it, it means it in the European sense of the word, not in the American sense. In America, when we say liberal, we mean people who care about social justice and who thinks there's an important role for government to play in the economy and so forth. But liberalism, as it's used in economics and in the European sense, is a system where there's faith that the private market can control the economy, can control it in the interests of the whole society, even though it appears to just operate in the benefit of individuals, each individual trying to do her best, make her own profit, somehow through some magical summation, operates in the interests of society as a whole. And the government that operates least and that is smallest is the government that's best in this system. And that's liberalism. It was the idea of Adam Smith, as he's often interpreted by many economists, though even he didn't really truly believe in this idea. And it was this system of laissez-faire, of government getting out of the economy and letting the economy control society, that ultimately broke down in the 1930s. And after the 1930s, with the Roosevelt and the New Deal, there was a different system of economics in our country. And with social democratic parties in Europe, there was a different kind of system in Europe, where there was a mixed economy. The government had an important role to play to manage and control and guide the private economy, especially the financial system. And that system worked pretty well for quite a number of decades, both in the United States and in Europe, though it had some very serious problems, of course, as well. But that system was a system that the bankers and the large corporations, after a while, did not like, because it restricted what they could do to make money. And little by little, through political lobbying and political power, the bankers and other corporations fought against this system to try to get the government from restricting their activity. And they designed a system that we economists call neoliberalism. That is a new form of this kind of laissez-faire policy that was so prominent in the late 19th and early 20th century. This rose with the political regime of Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain and Ronald Reagan in the United States, and was embedded both in the Republican Party and in strong elements of the Democratic Party as well, as I'll talk about in just a moment. And it's this system, this neoliberal system, that said bankers can control the financial system in the interests of everybody without very much government control. It's this system that has now crashed our economy. This deregulation of financial markets, that is getting the government out of the financial markets, and the transformation of governments in the United States, the United Kingdom, and other places to support the interests of business to the exclusion of everybody else, this at root, I think, is what has caused the crisis. Notice that this is not a truly laissez-faire system, because it's not as if the government completely got out, closed down, got out of doing business, got out of doing anything. But instead of acting as a fairly even referee, and in fact trying to help the poorest or the working class or those at the bottom get ahead, as they did under Roosevelt, government started acting to help big business and to help the big banks and to help the wealthy more than the rest of society as a whole. And I think it's this that helps to explain why so many people are angry at government. It's not so much that government can't do some good things. Of course, there are problems with government. But it's because for the last 30 or 40 years, 20 or 30 years especially, that government has weighed in more on the side of the rich than it has on the side of everybody else. And so when people say, you know, get the government out of my Medicare, there's a profound confusion there, obviously. But there's this anger at the government that has been putting its weight on the wrong side. With this financial deregulation, where banks and financiers could start doing pretty much whatever they wanted, it really helped the banks. It gave them more profit, gave them more wealth. And with this, they're able to get more political power and more political control. But it also led to excessive risk-taking, to strange and bizarre financial products like collateralized debt obligations and credit default swaps and all the things that you've been reading about and hearing about the last couple of years that basically nobody understood very well. Even the regulators, the Federal Reserve, they didn't really quite understand how these things were operate. Even the Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan or Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, they didn't really understand how these things operated. And in the end, these things seized up, crashed, and broke the system. But there's really kind of a deeper problem that I think connects up with this shift to a government rather than helping and weighing in on the side of the people, but instead helping the rich and the wealthy. There's this correlate of that. There's this thing that accompanies that that I think really can help us understand the crisis. That's the inequality of income and wealth in the United States and the United Kingdom rose to historic proportions during this last period. And here's a graph. I don't know if you can see it from where you're sitting, but it's the income share of the top 1% of the U.S. population from 1913 to 2006. And here's 1913, there's 2006. And you can see in 1929, just before the Great Depression, when the stock market crashed, the top 1% of the population had about 22% of the income produced in the United States. Then the Depression hit, their incomes fell, their share of income fell, and it kept going down more or less until the late 1970s. When Ronald Reagan and the Republican Revolution took over in the United States, and deregulation, this move towards a neoliberal system, occurred. There were tax cuts for the wealthy. Unions began to get busted. Government weighed in on the side of the rich. And ever since then, you see a huge increase in the share of income in the United States going to the top 1%. And by 2006, just before the current crash, once again, it was up at the level that it had been in 1929. Now, this is another very telling graph, which helps explain what's been going on. This isn't the share. This is the average income in dollar terms, in real terms, taking into account inflation, of the bottom 90% of the population. That's the green line. And the average share of the top 1%, this time starting in 1933, not 1913. Notice that ever since the late 1970s, the average income of most of the population, this is 90% of the population, just stagnated. The income has stagnated for the last 35 years for most of the people in our country. This is despite the fact that productivity has grown very rapidly. So the amount of stuff, the amount of income, the productivity of our economy has grown tremendously, but the bottom 90% hasn't gotten its share of it, of this bounty, of this productivity that has been created by people in our society. Who's gotten it? Well, The top 1% share went from about 50% in 1973 the top 1% grew very slowly, but after 1970s grew very rapidly, and now has grown by four or five times. This is 25 all the way up to 125. So it's the very top of the income distribution that has benefited from the hard labor, inventiveness, and growth, productivity growth of our society ever since the late 1970s. Now, this is a very complicated story about why this happened, and I can't tell you a simple answer even if I had it. But I think there are many components to why this was going on. In our society in the last several decades, we've had a focus on war rather than on the creation of social wealth. By social wealth, I mean a good educational system, a good housing for people, a society in which everybody could share equally. There's been a focus on supporting global expansion of U.S. corporations around the globe rather than having them invest here in the United States and create jobs here. And as I've said before, the use of the state to promote private rather than public purposes. All of these, I think, ended up in a sense contributing to a hollowing out of our economy, where we no longer have the same kinds of technical skills among our young people, no longer the same kind of education for our children, the manufacturing capability that we need to really make the transition that we're going to need to make to a green economy and to an economy where we can all prosper. I mean, think about it. We're all talking about making a green transition and creating solar panels and creating wind turbines and moving to a green economy. But the fact of the matter is, if you think about who's actually going to end up being producing most of this stuff, a lot of it's not going to be produced here. It's going to be produced elsewhere in the world, because elsewhere in the world they've developed the technological skills, the manufacturing capacity, and we would really have to work very hard to catch up. China comes to mind when we think about who's really going to be the leader in developing these kinds of manufacturing capacity if we don't do something to make the United States competitive in these areas. So it's within this general context that tonight I'm going to focus on the financial sector. It's within these general trends of hollowing out of our real economy and the state operating in the way that it has. But what I call a financialized economy has worsened and exacerbated all of these problems. Now, what do I mean by a financialized economy? I mean an economy where financial motives, financial markets, financial institutions have led and dominated our economy rather than the other way around. You know, when we teach economics and we teach money and banking and we teach finance, we say, what is the role of the financial sector? Well, the role of the financial sector is to support investment in the real economy. It's to intermediate savings from people who want to save to those who want to borrow to build small businesses and to create new jobs. And it's to help people save money now so that they can have money for their retirement, you know, 20 or 30 years from now. But in fact, that's not the way our financial system has been working. Rather than the financial system serving the needs of small businesses and firms and people for retirement, it's the small businesses and the firms and the people who want to retire, they're the ones who've been serving the financial system. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at your 401k plan, or you look at your pension fund, or you realize that Illinois has a $60 billion deficit in its state pension fund, I just read in the New York Times today, you realize that the financial system has not worked as the textbooks that we teach tells us it does. We have a financialized economy rather than an economy in which finance helps. So in this context, where real incomes have stagnated for 30 years, and where there's been this hollowing out of our manufacturing capacity, how can our economy expand? Who can buy the stuff that our economy produces? If people aren't generating the decent wages, getting the decent wages and have the high incomes, who's going to buy all the stuff that our economy produces? Well, the only way that our economy has been able to expand in the last 10 or 15 years is by what we call debt-led growth. People have borrowed money using their credit cards or using their houses to get second mortgages and used that borrowing to buy things and to keep our economy growing. But this debt-led economy is no substitute for a work-led, investment-led, income-led economy, and it's this debt-led economy that has crashed. Here's a graph of household debt relative to personal disposable income, that is, the average income that people have after they've paid taxes and so forth. And you can see, starting, this goes from 1952 to 2009, that in the 1960s and again around to the late 70s, it was pretty constant. But starting in the early 80s, people started taking on more and more debt relative to their income, so that by 2007, it was over 120% the amount of debt that people had taken on relative to their incomes, credit card debt, housing debt, and other forms of debt. And this was not sustainable. We can't sustain this rate of growth of debt in an economy. So this system of financialization, I would say, worsened an already weak economy. Now, our economy crashed, and I'll have more to say about that in a minute, but what are they trying to do now in the United States, Europe, and elsewhere? Rather than really transform the economy, rather than really try to solve these problems, there's a sense in which governments in the United States and elsewhere would like to just hit the restart button, go back to the way things were, rather than grappling with what has caused so many of us so much pain. That's certainly happening in the financial system here in the United States, where the New York Comptroller's Office just came out with a report that they come out with every so often about the top the bonuses of the large banks. The large banks' bonuses went up 17% last year. Their total compensation for the largest banks, for the top executives, is now higher than it was before the crisis. So they're so, from the banker's point of view, they've just hit the restart button. They're doing the same speculative trades they did before. And from government's point of view, they're not having a lot of success in really fundamentally changing the system. So what is the role of the financial system then, and what should we do about it? That's what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. We had the problem that we had from the point of view of the financial system is that, as I said, it was lightly regulated. Basically, the regulators turned a blind eye to what was going on and just let the banks do whatever they wanted to do, thinking that this would operate in the best interest of everyone. Alan Greenspan, who had been the head of the Federal Reserve, was especially committed to this idea of laissez-faire, neoliberalism, light regulation. In fact, if you think about it, the Federal Reserve had the authority under Alan Greenspan to rein in, if not completely stop, a lot of these insane loans that were made, these subprime loans that gave money to people who couldn't possibly afford it, that allowed the mortgage originators to pocket huge fees in doing this. Where there was enormous lying going on. The Federal Reserve had the authority under the Home Equities Owners Equity Protection Act of 1994 to insist on higher standards. And if they had enforced that, they could have stopped, I think, a lot of experts believe, a lot of these subprime loans that ended up being packaged into these complex securities, sold all over the world, and ultimately crashed the system. But Greenspan and the Fed didn't do anything about it. In fact, the Wall Street Journal quoted Greenspan. He says he didn't get heavily involved in financial regulatory matters because of his laissez-faire philosophy. He didn't think it was right for the Federal Reserve to restrict the bankers. By the way, Ben Bernanke was on Capitol Hill yesterday saying, don't take the Federal Reserve's regulatory authority away and give it to somebody else, because we're uniquely qualified to regulate the financial system. Well, fast forward to October 2008, maybe some of you have seen this, and Greenspan testified before Congress, and the headline said, well, he concedes an error on regulation. Oops. He said, quote, Those of us who have looked to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholders' equity, myself included, are in a state of shock disbelief. There's an interesting statement, because he's saying myself included. He means I am a shareholder in a lot of these banks, and I just saw my portfolio evaporate. Because I think that's why he was so upset. Referring to his free market testimony, his free market ideology, I have found a flaw. I have been very distressed by that fact. A flaw in the model that I perceived as the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works. That is, the self-regulating system where private interest will work in the interests of all. Henry Waxman kind of badgered him to try to finally get him to pin down what he meant. And he says, in other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology was not right. It was not working. And finally, Greenspan said, absolutely, precisely. That's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well. That is this laissez-faire approach. To me, this is the most amazing statement, that it's been working for 40 years. Because in fact, if you look at the history of global financial capitalism in the last 40 years, it's been one crisis after another. In fact, we have been locked in a devastating dynamic of deregulation, financial, quote-unquote, innovation, that is, the creation of new and dangerous financial products, of bubble or an explosion, and the system crashes, and then a bailout of the financial system. And then it starts all over again. If you look at this graph, it's a little hard to read, but it looks at the number of banking and financial crises globally from 1971 to 2007. And you can see that there's this cycle of relatively few crises, then a bunch of crises going on. This is the Mexican debt crisis, the so-called third world debt crisis. This is the more crises in Mexico. This is the Asian financial crisis. And amazingly, after each one of these crises, there was a lot of pain imposed on the countries that were having them, Mexico and so forth. The bankers were bailed out by the IMF or by the Federal Reserve or by the Treasury. And then rather than clamping down, imposing better regulation, more constraints on the banks, what did they do after each of these crises? They deregulated more, according to this laissez-faire neoliberal philosophy. And what I'm afraid of is that we're doing exactly the same thing this time. That rather than really coming up with serious financial regulation and reform, the government has bailed out the banks, is not going to have serious reform. Goldman Sachs and the others are going to go off doing what they've always done, and then the crisis once again is going to be even worse next time. Moreover, we're in an economic crisis now, a jobs crisis and so forth, and unless we get this under control, that's not going to change. So I'm afraid we might not have learned, the politicians and the bankers, might not have learned from history. There was a different period, though. This goes from 1900 to 2008. And this is a slightly different metric than the previous graph, but it's the same kind of thing. This is the proportion of countries with banking crises from 1900 to 2008. So in the Great Depression, for example, 40% of the countries had a banking crisis, 40% of the countries in the world. This is the panic of 1907, which I guess none of you remember. But it was about 12 or 13% of the countries in the world had banking crises. And these are the crises we were looking at before, the third world debt crisis, the Asian financial crisis, and so forth. Notice this. There was a period when there were very few or no crises. This is from the end of the Second World War, 1951 or so, and again, 1975. No crises. Why? Well, for one thing, this economy I talked to you about that had government regulation and so forth in the post-war period was growing very rapidly, so providing a lot of income and wealth in some parts of the world. But the other thing was that financial systems were very highly regulated during that period. There were strong regulations in the United States. There was the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment from commercial banking. There were limits on interest that could be charged. There was a lot of restrictions on the kinds of financial products that can be sold, and not just in this country, but all over the world. And that was a period of stability. And once deregulation kicked in, we once again went back to the old pattern of crises in the world. So what's going to happen now? Are we going to have serious reform and regulation and go back to this period? Or are we just going to keep going? Crises, more and more crises, up and down. Some of them extremely dangerous and serious, as we had before.
Can we vote?
Can we vote? Yeah. I know, you want to go back to the laissez-faire. Yeah. I know how you vote. Yes.
Yeah. And at the very tail end, right before the latest, what happened that made it dive down in 2005? See there? See how everything came down again?
Yeah.
What do you think was going on? It brought it down from
19. Do you have any idea? 2000? What? Strong economic expansion.
Just there weren't any banking crises. This is a graph of the proportion of countries.
Yeah, right.
So there weren't any.
It was a very short period. It was 1 year. So it just happened. Okay. You know, there had been these crises before. There had been these bailouts.
So economic expansion.
And then this was an expansionary period. So. What?
They're
getting ready to create the crisis. Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a different question. You're talking about how the dropping of regulations is what led to this.
One of the things.
Well, all right. I'm looking here and I'm seeing that it looks like it starts to go up about 73 or 74. It actually goes down a bit in, let's say, 78 or 9, and then starting in maybe 82 or 3 goes back up. And I'm sort of wondering, what were the fluctuations in regulation or deregulation to account for that? I tell you, I can think of something that accounts for the long-run trend.
What?
The end of Bretton Woods.
Yeah. Well, the end of Bretton Woods was a type of regulation.
Okay.
That's right.
It was also the end of the gold standard, what was left of it, by the way. The U.S. reneged.
He's got it, though.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a good point. The end of the Bretton Woods, for those of you who might know, was a set of an international agreement that fixed most exchange rates around the world to the dollar. Initially, it was also fixed to the gold, but that was kind of an artifact in a certain sense. It was really fixed to the dollar.
It fell. De Gaulle went in and started to raid Fort Knox at $35 an ounce, right?
That contributed to it, but the United States still has a lot of gold.
Because that's because we stopped, we reneged on the $35 an ounce
okay.
implicit
yeah.
commitment.
Yeah, I think that there was an implicit commitment of $35 an ounce. That's right. That's correct. And associated with Bretton Woods then was some very serious restrictions on market making in the global economy. You couldn't have wildly fluctuating exchange rates, which is a type of financial asset. And when that broke down, that led to a lot of instability, which did contribute both to more crises and to an explosion of financial innovations to try to people could reduce the risk associated with the ending of Bretton Woods and the fluctuations of exchange rates. That's right.
Follow this up. Would I be correct in my understanding that this, in this same period, a corollary to Bretton Woods and arguably the gold standard was stable interest rates? Didn't interest rates go bananas once Bretton Woods fell apart?
That's right. That's right. So, and interest rates were much more stable then. But then you had a number of other shocks to the economic system that were very important. I'm not saying that financial regulation explains everything. It's one factor. Then you had the oil crises of 74 and 79, which led to huge inflation, and then that was one of the reasons why interest rates started going up and down so much. So we had a lot of history going on here in addition to financial regulation. But certainly Bretton Woods was very, very important. Now, I don't know if you can see this, but one of the implications of this dynamic of explosion and bailout is that the financial system just kept growing and growing and growing. This is the total financial assets in the United States as a percentage of gross domestic product. That is, in relation to the size of the overall economy. And you'll see that it was pretty flat until around 1981. That's when Ronald Reagan was elected. Paul Volcker became head of the Federal Reserve. Deregulation started kicking in around this time. And financial assets, the financial sector just really started to explode. This is the assets of the top five investment banks. None of these are still investment banks. Lehman Brothers is no longer with us. Goldman Sachs became a bank holding company so that it could borrow money from the Federal Reserve and so forth. But you can see around that they started really growing very rapidly in the late 90s. So there were different kind of periods of explosion and deregulation, but the rate of growth in all these were very strong. Now, this is one of my favorite graphs. This is relative wages in the U.S. financial industry, 1930 to 2007. These are wages in the financial industry relative to average wages in the economy. Okay. Now, there are different components of financial industry. Okay. So the green one is just basic boring banking, you know, basic credit institutions. The orange is insurance. So pretty much this, you know, a little above one, which is the relative to other kinds of wages, but it doesn't grow very much. What's this? These are the sophisticated so-called sophisticated rainmakers in the investment banks and the large banks that started creating all these fancy financial products and speculation and derivatives and all of this. And their wages grew so that they were four times what the average wage was. And I have another graph, which I'm not going to show you because I don't want to overburden you with graphs, that shows that this went up dramatically even relative to people like rocket scientists, engineers, highly skilled individuals. And when I saw this graph, it explained something to me. I'm kind of dumb. I should have known this to begin with. But it explained to me why all of my students for the last 20 years in economics have wanted to go into banking. Instead of wanting to go into the educational sector, instead of wanting to do something that might have been somewhat more socially useful in a long-term sense, they all wanted to go into banking. And there were strong economic reasons why that was the case. So we had the explosion. Now what about the bailout? Well, you all know about TARP and the various forms in which the government bailed out the banks. Some estimates put the number as high as $13 trillion. Borowski did, the Inspector General of the, yeah. So there are a lot of numbers floating around there, and they're all a lot higher than my income. That's for sure. And well, and they're all a travesty. And when these bankers say that, well, we didn't get the bailout or we didn't want the bailout, it's just really not true. That there are many direct and indirect ways in which these banks were bailed out. You probably can't read this, but if you want to look at some good numbers, you could Google Nomi Prince, P-R-I-N-S, at Demos, D-E-M-O-S, and she has these numbers and explains all the bailout numbers. But you see there were all kinds of ways that this took place. Indirect loans and guarantees, direct loans to banks, various other kinds of indirect ways. The most dramatic, of course, was when the government invested $180 billion into AIG, the insurance company that wrote these very dangerous derivatives called credit default swaps. And when they gave $180 billion to AIG, AIG then passed on that money to large banks, both in the United States, like Goldman Sachs and others, as well as elsewhere in the world, like Credit Suisse and other banks, UBS and other banks elsewhere. So now the question is, you know, is the government going to demand some kind of quid pro quo for these huge bailouts? Is the government on our behalf going to demand that the bankers start operating in the interest of society as a whole? Or are we just going to start this cycle of explosion, bailout, explosion, crash, bailout? Are we going to start this cycle all over again? Now let's look at the kinds of regulations we used to have. I've talked about some of them before. We had the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed in the depths of the Great Depression in the 1930s, which separated investment from commercial banking and said that if you took in deposits as a commercial bank, you can't use that money to wildly speculate. You have to give it as loans to businesses and commerce. If you want to be an investment, a speculative bank, you can't be a commercial bank and take government-guaranteed deposits. There were segmented asset classes and institutions. Certain banks could only invest in certain kinds of things. They couldn't get into large conglomerates that would have enormous political power. There were restrictions on securitization, that is, the ability to do what happened in the subprime crisis, sell these subprime loans that people couldn't really afford, bundle them up, and then go to the rating agencies, like Moody's or Standard & Poor's, with these highly opaque, complex securities that nobody really knew what was in them, and say to Standard & Poor's, look, can you rate these AAA so that pension funds can buy it? And Standard & Poor's says, well, I don't know if those are really AAA. I mean, U.S. Treasury bonds are AAA. Are those things really as safe as the debt of the U.S. government? And Lehman Brothers and the others said, well, if you won't give us a AAA, we'll go over to Fitch or Moody's and we'll give our business to them. And Standard & Poor's said, okay, well, maybe we can make a deal. If you just change this little thing or that little thing, we'll rate it AAA. And so it's taking coal and making it seem like diamonds and selling it to unsuspected people. Well, there were restrictions on that before. That couldn't have happened before. Well, this system broke down largely as a result of lobbying by financial institutions and regulatory institutions saying, okay, we'll change our regulations and we will stop enforcing them so that you can do this kind of stuff. A very interesting report that you might want to look at says that U.S. financial institutions spent over $5 billion on lobbying and campaign contributions the past 10 years, both to Republicans and to Democrats, precisely to get these kinds of changes. The name of this report is Sold Out, How Wall Street and Washington Betrayed America, and it was put together by the Consumer Education Foundation, Essential Information. You can find it on the web. Very interesting report. Now, this deregulation led to the creation of a shadow banking system where there was no regulation at all. Hedge funds, private equity funds, basically no regulation at all. And this was supported both by Democrats and Republicans. This was not just a Republican thing. In fact, President Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, and Assistant Larry Summers, who's now Barack Obama's chief economic advisor, they tried to make sure that these very complex derivatives that have now crashed our system were not regulated by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, as Brooksley Bourne, a very interesting woman who was the chair of that commission, had proposed in 1998. Well, Rubin and Summers, they said, no, we don't want these things regulated. And also, they supported the idea of getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act as well. Rubin becomes chair of Citigroup's executive board after that, and Larry Summers moved up to become Secretary of Treasury and eventually president of Harvard. And while he was president of Harvard, he earned $5 million working for a hedge fund.
What?
A hedge fund, Larry Summers did. So these things were not really, were not regulated at all. There's a second factor, I think, that a law professor named Bill Black, William Black, who teaches at the University of Kansas, has convinced me of and convinced a lot of economists about, and I think I was talking to somebody over here about this earlier, that it wasn't just a matter of deregulation, but there was widespread fraud in the financial markets. You were saying that Madoff ran this Ponzi scheme, but he's a small potatoes compared to a lot of what was happening on Wall Street. And what Bill Black, who was a financial regulator during the savings and loan crisis, says, and he wrote this book which says, the best way to rob a bank is to own one. That's the title of his book.
Said that.
Who?
He said Bertolt Brecht.
Okay, Bertolt Brecht said everything first.
Said,
I know.
What is robbing a bank?
Good. Okay. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that Bertolt had a word to say about that, which I'm not surprised. Did any of you see Michael Moore's film, Capitalism: A Love Story? Well, Bill Black was one of the main talking heads in there. You remember him talking about how you put holes in the dam and the dam starts to break apart, and that's him. Anyway, what he says is that when you deregulate, you decriminalize. It's like taking the cop off of the street They're no longer examining the banks because the banks can do whatever they want, and it makes it virtually impossible to find fraud. So this idea of deregulation and creation of fraud, I think, are very intimately connected. So the impact, I think you know a lot of this, so I'll run through it pretty quickly, but it's very grim. People have lost 25% or more of their wealth in this crisis. More than 3 million homeowners have lost their homes. Right now, of home foreclosures are running at $170,000 per month. Pardon?
$170,000 homes per month.
Right. Unemployment, which is officially around a little less than 10%, but that really is an underestimate because it doesn't take into account the fact that people who want full-time jobs can't get full-time jobs. If you just work 1 hour a week, you're counted as being employed. Or if you've been looking for work for months and you can't find a job and you get discouraged and stop looking, you're not included in the unemployment statistics. So if you look at the a broader definition of unemployment, it's more like 17, 18, 20%. In some areas, I think in some parts of Michigan, it's even higher, 24%. During the Great Depression, it was 25%. So in some areas, we're pushing up towards what we were experiencing during the Great Depression. Certain groups have been particularly hit. Young people, Hispanics, people working in construction, males have been particularly hard hit on the job front as well. One of the really troubling signs is the long-term unemployment. The share of the unemployed out of a job for 27 weeks or more is now at higher than it's been at any time since they've calculated the statistics, since 1948. So the long-term unemployed as a share of the total unemployment is about 40%.
How does that compare to the Great Depression?
We don't have those data on long-term unemployment. These comparable data were not collected then. Change in the labor force participation rate by age. This means people who are actually looking for jobs, trying to get jobs or have jobs. It's declined very rapidly among young people. They can't find jobs. I have a son who's coming out of college this year. I have no idea what his prospects are. I'm sure many of you are in similar situations. My son's lucky because he has a family safety net. Many other kids aren't that lucky. Now, 40% of the unemployed have been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, not 40% of the population. Yeah, I think that's a good point. And towards the end, I'm going to be talking about how we should re-regulate. The question is, what was the rationale for regulation? And maybe it was partly that there was over-regulation after the savings and loan crisis. So towards the end of my talk, I'm going to talk about what regulation might look like, and then we might have a discussion about the proper type of regulation.
Wasn't increasing home ownership part of this issue too? Making credit available to more people, people that probably wouldn't normally qualify for loans?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I think, let me just address this briefly, because this is important. Well, there's another version of this, which is blame the government-sponsored agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that the government had this policy of trying to create more affordable housing, that the government-sponsored agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, pushed out and these subprime loans, and that they are really responsible. Once again, it's the government's fault and not the private market's fault. And the Republicans are particularly pushing this. And the truth of the matter is, there's two points here. These were not really government institutions. These institutions had implicit government guarantees that if they were to go bankrupt, the government would bail them out. And so everybody thought that they were government institutions, but they actually operated very much on the private profit motive. And their executives were making incomes like the private banking executives were making. So it was really not a government institution per se. That's number one. Number two is that they got into the game very late. After the housing bubble and the subprime thing really took off with private, purely private institutions, towards the end it is true that the executives at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac became friends with the head of Century Real Estate, what's his name, Milizzo? They became good friends. They started buying this paper and so forth. But it was towards the end, not it really wasn't at the beginning or wasn't a dominant force for most of the time. So yes, there is some blame for these institutions, but it's not the main story, which I think a lot of Republicans are trying to pin on it. So who lost Wall Street? Who's to blame for all this? And this leads right into this. Well, as I just said, there was a whole social superstructure in the last 20 years, I think, that shares part of the blame. There's the media that, you know, that really didn't ask the tough questions about the housing bubble, about these risky financial products. In fact, they were trying to pump up the stock market and get everybody to invest in these things, and perhaps they still are. And there were very few critical voices in the media about this, as there was very few critical voices in the media, say, about the war in Iraq or many other things. So the media, is partly to blame. Economists, my compatriots, as June implied in her introductory remarks, they had an ideology, this laissez-faire ideology, that it was more efficient to let the financial markets run the economy. But there was also corruption in the economics profession. A graduate student and I have studied top financial economists, and we've looked at their connections with private financial firms, hedge funds, investment banks, and so forth. And we've looked at the degree to which, when they write an op-ed piece, appear on TV, write an article about regulation, the degree to which they identify the fact that they are working for private financial firms, as well as being professors of economics at the University of Chicago or wherever. And we looked at 19 top financial economists who are well known. And there's only one of them. Virtually all of them had these private financial connections, 80% of them did. And only one of them identified himself as having them when he was giving advice about financial regulation and so forth. And the reason he was always identifying himself that way is because he owned a private financial firm and he was trying to promote it. So he wanted people to go to his website and see what his private financial firm was doing and try to get them to invest in the firm. None of the others identified themselves this way. And almost none of them were supporting any type of reasonable financial regulation in the buildup to the crisis. So it's partly ideology, partly corruption. Now, in order to get out of this mess, we have to have, I think, a complex interconnected set of policies. And I'll go through a bit of a laundry list, but then I'm going to focus on the financial sector again. Once again, the stimulus package that the Obama administration put together that the Republicans helped to shape was not big enough and was not oriented well enough, but it did save or create 2 million jobs. Things would have been much worse without it. We need another stimulus package to start putting people back to work, and I'll say more about that in a minute. We need economic policies to start raising wages in the economy. One thing that Roosevelt and John Maynard Keynes figured out in the 1930s is you can't revive the economy by cutting wages. Because if you cut wages, people don't have income, they can't buy things, you have to raise wages. This was the fundamental fight that John Maynard Keynes had with the economics profession. The economics profession said, the way you get out of a crisis is lower wages, costs will go down, firms will become more competitive, they'll be able to sell more stuff, and the economy will revive. And Keynes said, no, it's the opposite. If you keep cutting wages, you're going to keep cutting incomes, people aren't going to be able to buy things, then people aren't going to be able to sell things, and the economy is going to keep going down and down and down. So we need policies that are going to raise wages and incomes in the economy. And that means policies to support those groups within the society that can help workers get better wages. And this includes unions. This includes changing labor laws so that they're more union friendly. This includes helping communities keep teachers on the job, and we need revenue sharing and so forth. So we need to figure out ways to raise wages and create more employment. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. And we can't do it alone. Point number four is we need to have international cooperation and get other countries to help on this. So I want to first talk about job creation, because this is the most important in a certain way. We're not going to get out of this crisis until we start creating more and better jobs. My colleague at the University of Massachusetts, Robert Polin, who's done a lot of work on green jobs and so forth, has just published an article in The Nation magazine, the lead story. It says, what we need to do is create 18 million jobs in 3 years. If we do that, then by the time Barack Obama comes up for re-election, the unemployment rate will be back down to about 4 or 4.5%, as it was before the crisis. Now, how could we do this? To do this, we need to create 500,000 jobs per month, or a bit more than 4% growth in job creation over the next 3 years. Now, Pollan says we can do this by a general stimulus package in the economy, much bigger than the $15 billion that the House just passed, which is really a paltry sum and won't do much of anything. But then we need some very specific policies. And more specifically, we need to mobilize the resources of the banking system. Here's the thing. You and I and all of us in this room and everybody who's a taxpayer in the country, we bailed out the banks. What did they give us in return? Not much. They're still engaging in the same speculative activities they were before. Moreover, they're sitting on about $850 billion of excess reserves that are just sitting there on their books. They're not doing anything with these. In fact, the Federal Reserve is making it worse, and that the Federal Reserve is paying them interest, a small interest rate, for them to hold on to these reserves. And it's the Federal Reserve's way of once again trying to give more subsidies to the banks to help them do better. What we need to do is come up with a set of carrots and sticks, a set of policies, to get these banks, who we bailed out directly and indirectly, to start investing that money in job creation. Banks certainly have to hold some excess reserves to guard against a crisis. So let's say they held on to $200 billion, which is kind of the typical average. Then there's still $650 billion, at least, that they should be investing. Moreover, as I said before, we own 80% of AIG, the insurance company. We should have this insurance company start writing policies to help give guarantees for banks and others that lend money to create jobs. We'll start using this insurance company that we own to start serving social purposes. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I think, can use some reorganization as well to start doing more to stem the housing crisis. What are some carrots and sticks that the government can use to start mobilizing these funds? One is loan guarantees. That is, you tell banks that if they invest in job-creating kinds of investments, the government will guarantee part of the payment, because banks are afraid now to do that because the economy is not in good shape and they're worried they won't get paid back. So we can use some loan guarantees. Taxes on excess reserves. The government should say, look, rather than paying you interest, we're going to actually tax away the excess reserves unless you start investing it in job creation. A third kind of policy, which is related to these, a little more complicated, economists call it asset-backed reserve requirements. What they say is to banks, if you use the money to invest in things that will create jobs, we're going to lower the tax on you. But if you use it for speculative or other purposes, we're going to raise the tax on you. So that's another version of that. So in other words, we need to mobilize the resources that are already there in the banking system to lend to small businesses, to lend to cooperatives, to start generating jobs. Now, not just any jobs. We need to create green jobs, jobs in education. We need to make investments that generate a lot of jobs rather than a few jobs. And my colleague, Bob Pollan, and his colleagues at the university, I don't know if you can see this, but their basic finding is that if you invest $1 billion in spending, you generate a lot more jobs in educational services, 29,000, healthcare, 19,000, clean energy, 17,000, than if you take that money and use it for military spending. So another part of the plank is let's start stop spending so much money on war and start spending more money on education and health, clean energy, and you'll also generate a lot more jobs if you do that. What about the banking system itself? And I'm almost at the end now. The policy of Geithner, Summers, Bernanke, and unfortunately the president has been to socialize the losses, that is, bail out the banks, and privatize the benefits, that is, create bonuses for Goldman Sachs. What we need is a more fundamental reform of the financial system. We need banking to return to its core mission, the mission that we talk about in our money and banking textbooks. First of all, we need to end too big to fail. If banks are too big to fail, they're too big to exist. We need to break them up. And we know a lot about how to do that. We need to put back into place a Glass-Steagall kind of policy that separates banking gambling with public funds from banking that actually adds to jobs that can be supported by the public. We should make all risky financial products, make sure that they are not created in the dark, that nobody understands them. Take, for example, what happened in Greece. I don't know if you've been following this, but you know, Greece is on the verge of going bankrupt. It turns out that some investment banks, particularly Goldman Sachs in 2001, helped them figure out a way that they could spend excessive amounts of money without putting it on the books of the country, without telling the rest of the European Union. What they did is they turned loans into an elaborate foreign exchange trade. And according to the rules of the European Union, you don't have to report foreign exchange trades, but you have to report loans. As a result, Greece was able to keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, increase their debt, and now they're in crisis, and the euro might be in crisis as a result. We need to get rid of all these obscure financial products, make them so they can be sold on exchanges. If they're sold on exchanges, like the exchange here in Chicago, they have to have a certain degree of transparency, a certain degree of openness, and so people can understand them. We need to have a financial speculation tax. You can put a small tax on financial trades that can generate many billions of dollars that can be used for social purposes. This is being proposed not just by wild-eyed radicals, but it's being proposed by Gordon Brown. It's being proposed by others in England. It's not being supported by many American politicians, but it is being supported by some in Congress, the AFL-CIO. We need to have a financial speculation tax. The way this tax would work, it's a very tiny amount, so that if when you make your investment in the stock or your pension fund does, and hold that investment for a year or 2 years, they're not even going to feel it. It'll feel like nothing. But what it's going to affect is people like these banks who are making billions of dollars of trade, holding them for an hour or 2 hours or 10 minutes or 1 day. Then a very small tax will really add up. So it will be a lot of money from them, or better yet, even discourage them from making these kinds of speculative trades that will be felt very little, if any, by people who are making long-term trades, so it won't affect the population. Of course, the bankers will claim this will be a drag on the economy, but as he said, no, it's just going to really raise the cost of these highly speculative, churning kinds of trades that are very short-term. But this isn't enough. We need more fundamental financial reform, I think, to make finance for the people and not for the bankers. We need to create a banking system where there's more social control, not just more regulation, but more social control at different levels of banking. One way to do it is to turn banks like into public utilities, like the electric company was, or other public utilities that we know about, where they're very highly regulated, very highly restricted in what they can do to serve the public interest, but at the same time, a reasonable profit is more or less guaranteed. A second way to do this is to create public options in banking. Just like we want a public option in the healthcare sector, have a public option in banking. For example, take one of these banks that we invested a lot of money into and turn it into a public bank. What would a public bank do? Well, a public bank could lend money for more green jobs, for more green investment. It could become a cooperative bank. It could lend money to those who want to start cooperatives, cooperative businesses, social businesses. These kinds of people are now rationed out of the market. They can't get a loan. But a public bank could see the value of cooperatives. Yes? That's right. Create a better environment for credit unions, including more insurance, more subsidized loans, increase the amount of lending that credit unions could do. Credit unions are a type of cooperative. So have a backup bank with more resources that could help credit unions if they get in trouble. So for example, community banks and credit unions now are getting in trouble because of the crisis. Who are they going to turn to for their bailouts? And these are actually financial institutions that are serving the social interest. We need to have more of a social safety net to help those kinds of institutions as well. Generally, I think what we need to do is create more opportunities for what I call finance without financiers. That is, financial institutions that are run by communities, that are run more by cooperatives, that are run more by people rather than financiers. And we have many examples of this throughout Europe. In North Dakota, there's a public bank. We need to use government funds to help kickstart these kinds of institutions. So I talked about we need public banks to promote these things. So what can you do? What can we do? Well, there's one easy thing to do at the beginning. If you have any money, move it. Move it out of the big banks, the Bank of America, Citibank, Chase banks. Move it into credit unions. Move it into cooperative banks. Move it into community banks. If you look on the Roosevelt Institute website, they talk a lot about what good this kind of activity can do. A second thing that has more political force is I urge you to look at the Americans for Financial Reform. This is a coalition of over 200 groups. They have a website, ourfinancialsecurity.org. They're pushing very hard for financial restructuring, financial reform. They have groups all over the country. They have activities and actions that people can take, from demonstrations to calling your congressperson, pushing for financial reform. They have a lot of educational materials. So if you are interested in trying to do something in this area, I strongly urge you to contact Americans for Financial Reform. If you go on their website, they'll tell you who's operating here in Chicago. The head of it actually is Heather Booth. Have you ever heard of her? She has a long history here in Chicago. So she's the head of this organization. It's a very good organization. I've done a lot of work with them. I strongly recommend that you make contact with them. For example, this week they have a series of actions of calling Congress people, senators, and so forth, because financial reform is really coming to a head now in the Senate. It's very unlikely that they're going to have a very good bill coming out of that. But people who AFR is working with are trying to put in better amendments to these kinds of bills to make them better. So, but they're not just using legislative actions. They're getting people out into the streets. They're protesting particular banks and what they're doing. So it's not just a legislative kind of action. It's a set of other actions as well. Finally, since it's a peace group that's sponsoring this talk, I urge peace groups and financial reform groups. When I talk to financial reform groups, I tell them the same thing: get in touch with peace groups. We have to start having more coalitions among these different groups if we're going to have a chance of changing the system. Thank you very much.